mathematics of electronics, so I do, you know, pick out those particular emails and give them some little extra attention. And he says, here, basically, what happened here? What happened? Oh, okay. He was, they gave, they got a problem, one of the books he got, he and his friend, and they said they cannot get the right answer. For some reason, they get one part of the problem correct, but the other, they can't. So he wanted me to interpolate all this jazz, as they say. I guess that's your expression. Given, he says here, this one particular problem, the frequency is 3.8 megahertz, okay? And it has a capacitance of 438.5 pf, right? And he says, this was part two. Part one, they get the right answer, okay. Part one was 3.8 megahertz with a 4 microhenry coil. And that one says they get the right answer, and they feel they got the right answer. And in the bottom, they says also, they gave a hint that X of L has to X equals X of C in the total reaction. I'll explain that, I guess, a little bit more to him in a minute. And he wants to know why, and I got, you know, the information, what calculators they use, and all that kind of stuff. And it basically comes down to this, and it's something that we learned a long, long time ago. You got to watch the decimal point. How many places before and how many places after. You have to understand the formulas. Now, back in days of, I guess, Dick and myself, we had to use slide rules. We didn't have to calculate it. So you had to do a lot of interpolating and all, and you had to do a lot of little paper figuring. Now, when he took the formulas, Tim, of X of L equals to 2 pi FL. Let me explain this formula to you. First of all, F, the frequency, is in hertz. And the L is in Henry, based on Henry. So now, if you were to really write this formula out in detail, you would get 3.8 times. Now, we use 10 to the 6 rather than write all those zeros, because you got to remember, again, it's based on hertz, so it's 3,800,000 hertz that you're dealing with here. So we write 3.8 times 10 to the 6. Now, you said it also was a 4 microhenry choke in there, a coil in there. That would be now, 4 microhenry is 4 millionths of a part of a henry. So now we know this has to be 4 times 10 to the minus 6, because we've got to put those zeros in this part. These zeros tell us that it's decimal point zeros, and then 4 tells us that it's part of the microhenry. That's the formula. These are F and the L. You must understand that. Now, why, when you did this part of it, it came out right? You notice that we have 10 to the 6 and a 10 to the minus 6. Well, this came, that's what we used to do. We used to add and subtract exponents, so that when you finished the problem, you knew how many zeros and what to count, you know, how many decimal places before and after. So when you took this now and you just multiply 3.8 times 4, you came out to 95.5, which is correct, because it automatically, I can say, because it just has to go straight forward. That's how they caught you. And on the second part. So, okay, now I'm going to get to the second part. First, Dick, do you want to make any comments? Did I leave out anything? I'm trying to make this as clear as possible. Over.
No, you're right on. With exponential mathematics, once you learn how to do that, the 3.8 megacycles, the 3.8 times 10 to the plus 6 hertz, that means megahertz, and the 4 microhenries is going to be 4 times 10 to the minus 6 henries. Multiply those two together, you end up with 15.2. Multiply that times the 2 pi that's required, and you get 15.5 1 ohms. I think it is 10 by 11. Double check that. 15.50 ohms. Question? 90, yeah. 15.5, 2 ohms, I think it was, when you multiply by 2 pi, 6.28, you end up at 95.5. So the inductor reactance will be 95.5. When you get the mathematics right, it's a little bit more difficult in the case of the capacitor. You're multiplying by capacitance in picofarads, which Mel's about to tell you is 10 to the minus 12. And when you multiply again by 3.8 megasine, or 3.8, 10 to the 6, you multiply that together, and you multiply it by 2 pi, and then you have to take 1 over that. When you do all that, the capacitive reactance is going to be 95.51. So inductive reactance, 95.50. Capacitive reactance, 95.51. They are so closely equal to each other. The capacitive reactance, for all practical purposes, equals the inductive reactance, and that is a beautiful resonant circuit when you put that inductor and that capacitor together. And so that's the way I see it. Now back to you, Mel.
Roger, this is K2KY. Okay, now that second part, like I say, or the first and the second part, the X of C, this is where you have to listen to him very carefully, because he told me about the calculator, and I'll tell you step by step, Dick just mentioned, we're going to be dealing with picofarads. Now, they gave you 3.8, and the capacitor is 438.5 PS, or we used to call microfarads. Now, again, frequency, the F in this formula, again, is based on Hertz, and the capacitance is based on picofarad. Now, pico is a part, again, a part of a farad. It's based on a farad. That's the formulation. When they made this formula up, they based it on a complete farad. Now, a pico is a very small part of a farad. In fact, as Dick said, it's 10 to the minus 12. So now, take your calculator. We'll do it. We'll do the bottom part of the problem first. We got 2 pi. Now, as I said before, we got 3.8, 10 to the 6. Write that down. Then we have times the 438.5 of the capacitance, times, now, to get the, now, you see, we've got to get to a minus, now, say 10 minus 12. But on your calculator, as you said, oh, by the way, I think you even mentioned you weren't sure how to get to 10 to the 6th. So I better go over that again, because I see I have a note here. But you get to get the base 10 to the 6th. You'll see that you have over on the left, it has an orange key, and it says second function. It says second with a little F. That means second function. If you push that, you also see then to the right, you see an E to the X, and in the little box above it, it says 10 to the X. That means to the base 10. So we're going to start all over again. We're going to go 2 pi times 3.8 times, now you push the second function, the little 10 will come up, and now you push a 6. And now we go on to the next part of it, times 438.5 times, just put the time sign, don't forget the time sign. Now, if you see here at the bottom, you see a key that's marked EXP. That's for the exponential, to change the sign. Now, next to that is a little minus, you know, like a little parenthesis that has up. So when you push EXP, you'll see an E pop up. Now push that E next to it where it says minus, in the parentheses, a little minus, and you see a minus now pop up. And now you're pushing 12, mark 1, 2. So that's what you should be now seeing on your calculator. And if you're equal now,
Mel, you're,
sorry.
Yeah, that push to talk switch is giving you a little trouble.
Yeah, my finger gets to see. So, okay, I don't know how much we missed here. I'll go back. I'll back up again where you had the. Again, I'll repeat the whole thing to make sure you got it all, Tim. 2 pi times 3.8. Push the second function. base 10 comes up when you push that E. Now you put the 6 in, put the time sign in again, 438.5, the time sign again, push EXP, that's the exponential key. You'll see a big E come up. Now push the minus, that's the one in the little parentheses right next to it, the minus. You'll see a minus come up in the corner there, right above the E. And now push 12, and you'll see the little 12 come up. Now when you push equal, you'll see 0.0105. 0.0105. Now remember, the formula was 1 over. So what you can do, you can put the 0.0105. You can put that, push the key that next to it says store A. Push it in store A. See the key there? It says store A. Now push clear. Now you're going to push number 1. You're going to put 1 in, but that's what the formula calls for, 1. Put 1 in, and now put divide, push divide key. Now you have a key that says recall, right there, right underneath the store key, it says recall, and you recall A. So you're going to see now, come up, 1 divided by 0.0105. And when you push the equal key, you're going to see 95 now, 0.5 come up. That's why they gave you at the bottom one, as I just said, the T took the words out of my mouth. That's why when they gave you X of L is equal to X of C, that was a hint that the total reactance is going to actually be 0. So this is, see, the whole trick of this is understanding. You've got to remember, we got Mico, Pico, we got Mega, we got Billy, we got all these. You've got to understand that the calculator is doing what we used to do by hand. It's terrific with how accurate the calculator is, but you still must understand that there are decimal places. It's not going to automatically understand the formulas just because, you know, you punch in the numbers. Okay, I think that I covered this correctly, over.
You sure did. Each calculator is a little bit different in the way that front panel is set up for the 1 over X function. In other words, in my Hewlett-Packard calculator, I can easily do something where you got a great big calculation in the denominator, and that's what the capacitive reactance is, 1 over 2 pi FC. And once you multiply the 2, the pi, the F, which is 3.8 megahertz, and the C, the 438.5 picofarads, you multiply that all together, you've got all the numbers that are in the denominator. But now you have to divide that into 1. In my Hewlett-Packard calculator, there's one key that does it. It's the 1 over X key. It does an inversion. Mel, with his particular calculator, does it by putting it into a temporary memory and then doing this divide function by dividing it into 1. Well, I guess you could, that particular calculation, capacitive reactance, is an extremely good example of the apparent advantage of reverse Polish notation, the old-fashioned Hewlett-Packard type calculators. There you're doing everything in a particular order where it becomes easier to do that calculation with a algebraic calculator. The 1 over X requirement of capacitive reactance becomes a little bit difficult without using intermediate memory steps and whatever. I know that reverse Polish is becoming less and less popular in time. I'm a little bit disappointed with that. And so I keep buying these old Hewlett-Packard Model 28S calculators because I like the way they're set up. I like reverse Polish notation, but the calculator also will tolerate algebraic and Lisp and Forth and BASIC and Fortran. All of those 6 languages you can put into the machine into one formula, and the machine figures out what you want. The guys at Corvallis, Oregon, the computer network works of Hewlett-Packard, did an extremely good human engineering job of designing that calculator. And the and the engineers in Europe just loved Hewlett-Packard, just couldn't get enough of them. The engineers in the United States never discovered them. They discovered Casio, Sharp, and Texas Instruments, and they never got to Hewlett-Packard because the Hewlett-Packard was a little bit more expensive. And in my opinion, what they bought was penny-wise, pound-foolish. The price you pay for a calculator, I don't care if it's $10, $100, or $1,000, that is not the cost. The true cost is the amount of time it takes for you to learn to use the machine. How user-friendly is it, or how user-hostile is it? The Hewlett-Packard machine, to a guy that's smart enough, was very user-friendly. I don't give a damn what the hell the price was, I was going to pay it, because I wanted user-friendliness. That's my opinion. I'm in the minority. I mean, I worked for a company with 1,050 engineers. Real smart people, I thought. And I could go up and down those aisles and say, what calculator are you using? I found three human beings in that building of 1,050 four-year graduate engineers and above. Three human beings had a Hewlett-Packard calculator. The rest of them said, how in the world can you tolerate reverse Polish? It is so different from everything I've ever learned with algebraic notation. And I think they missed the boat. The engineers in Europe said, how in the world can you guys tolerate anything but reverse Polish notation? So part of what Mel told you is the way his calculator works, and maybe Mel, Tim gave you a picture of his calculator, maybe it's the same as yours, and maybe the sequence is the same. And maybe all algebraics are the same. But I know that among the few reverse Polish machines on planet Earth, there's a significant amount of difference to the way those front panels are set up. But at least by listening to what Mel was saying, even though your keys may not be exactly the same, your mileage may differ. Once you understand the concept of 1 over divide into 1, which is what you got to do with a capacitance formula, then it'll become a little bit more simple. Now when you know the answer is going to be 95.5 ohms, keep playing with your calculator until it gives you that answer, then you've learned the process. That's one way of doing it, almost reverse engineering. K2KEY, K2RIW.
And so we have six.
Okay, yeah, go ahead with your comment, Rich.
Hey, Dick. A little hard to talk. It's interesting you brought up the RPM, because I was going to ask you that a couple of weeks ago. What do you recommend? Is anything still available new? What do you use, and how much in the market?
Okay, when that exact question was given to me by Doug McGarrett, W-A-2-S-A-Y, who when he was living in Queens frequently signed into the TechNet, and I told him that I'm in love with the Hewlett-Packard 28S calculator, 28 Sierra, which was a machine invented in 1988, and it became a discontinued product from Hewlett-Packard at around 1998 or so. Or maybe 2000, but somewhere around there became a discontinued product. I fell in love with that product so much that I own a total of 4 of them. 2 of them I've destroyed over the years by dropping them on the concrete so often. And I keep buying them from eBay and other places that are selling used equipment. I even bought one of them from one of the guys at League headquarters. I bought one from, why can't I think of his call letters now? K6... VT was it? He's now W1VT. I'll think of his name. Anyhow, I bought his calculator because he wasn't using it. So I fell in love with that particular machine. Okay, Doug, W-A-2-S-A-Y, got the machine in his hand, and he said, Dick, how the hell can you tolerate that thing? The left-hand keyboard is all the letters, the right-hand keyboard is all the numbers, and a bunch of other functions on both. But the left-hand keyboard is not a QWERTY keyboard. It's A, B, C, D, not QWERTY. And because he is a fast typer, I'm not, I'm a fine and peck typer, for me to type with a keyboard that's A, B, C, D, it's perfectly all right. For him, he says, you're crazy, and he just couldn't sell the machine fast enough. So I'm a little reluctant to tell you what I use, because I'm using old machines, and I'm stuck as a dinosaur in my old ways. I love reverse Polish, and some of the really good modern machines, the Hewlett-Packard. Unfortunately, the bean counters started taking over the company. They're decimating the company. The morale is going into the toilet. This is one of the best technical companies on planet Earth. And over the last few years, the bean counters are starting to destroy the place. And they convinced the management of the company, the calculators are not where the great profit is, and therefore they dropped the product line, even though they had some really beautiful products. But there are calculators out there where you can ask the machine to either listen to you in the reverse Polish mode, or the algebraic mode, or the Fortran, or the Lisp, or whatever mode you like. There are machines that will do that, and the Hewlett-Packard 28S will not. But I can now see that it doesn't solve everyone's problems. Not everyone thinks the way I do. And the Europeans do. I was a member of the British users group of Hewlett-Packard calculators. And boy, that was a tightly knit fraternity of people who understood what quality is. And the American engineers just didn't. I'm very disappointed they didn't catch on to this one. So I can't tell you what brand name or what model, but now you know a little bit more what to look for. Some of the more modern calculators do not have a folding keyboard like the Hewlett-Packard 28S does, and that gives me more than twice the number of keys. And I like having a lot of keys. The modern-day calculators think everyone doesn't want folding, therefore they end up with less than half the number of keys, therefore there's not enough keys to find all the functions, therefore you've got first function, second function, third function, or when it comes to finding your favorite command, you've got to go to menus of menus of menus, and it just drives me crazy. By the time you go one or two menus down to try to find your particular favorite calculator function, like a tangent of X, we'll say, it's so frustrating to find out where it is in some of the more modern machines that you end up spelling it out the hard way on the keyboard. And that's not much of a solution. So as you can see, calculators are troublesome. Not everybody will agree with whatever brand. Not everybody likes Blonde. Not everybody likes... In fact, I'm in the minority. The vast majority of engineers say, Rich, how the hell do you keep using that calculator? I give them the answer and they look at me funny. Back to you, Rich. Rich, on that particular transmission, you were 75% dropout. Each time you said a word, you dropped out of the machine. Your signal is extremely weak, but I think I get the main point of what you're asking. Reverse Polish notation, what's called reverse Polish, is pronounced Lukasiewicz. When you see it spelled out, it looks like Lukasiewicz, but it's pronounced in Poland by Lukasiewicz as a family name. This man, a good mathematician in Poland, came up with what's called postfix protocol of programming machines. The way reverse Polish works is that you first type in the number, like in this particular calculation, you would type in 3.8 megahertz, 3.8, and you'd hit the exponential key, and then you'd hit 6, 3.8 exponential 6, and the machine would know you're putting in 3,800 hertz. You would then plug in the second number. You wouldn't be putting in add, subtract, multiply, divide. You just put in the first number and press enter. And so you've got a screen that's got four lines to it. And now the number you just plugged in moved up one line. The second number you would be putting in is 438.5. Then you'd hit the exponential key and you'd hit 12. And then you'd hit the minus key. Everything is after. You first put in number A, you put in number B, and then you say to the machine, this is what I want you to do with it. If I was adding two numbers, I would put in A, enter, B, and then press the plus key. So you're doing the operation after telling it what you're operating on. That's what the whole reverse Polish idea is. But now, let me show you how fast and easy it works on that very difficult calculation of calculating capacitor reactance. So once again, I put in 3.8E6. Enter. Then I put in 438.5, exponential 1, 2. Then I hit the minus sign. Then I would hit enter on the second number. I wouldn't have to, but I would. So I've now got two numbers on the screen, the 3.8 number and the 438.5 number, with all of their extra zeros because of the exponential thing. Then I would hit the multiply key, and they too would be multiplied together. Then I'd hit the 2 number, enter, and hit multiply key. Then I'd hit the pi number, if I want, enter, and multiply. Some of these enters are not required, because I'm just doing it to make it one step easier. And I'd hit multiply. So now I've got all the jazz and the denominator multiply, entered into the machine, all multiplied together. Then I'd hit, simply hit the 1 over x key, which would really be dividing it into 1, and out would come 95.5 ohms. So in the case of this rather difficult calculation with a reverse Polish machine, my goodness, does it happen fast if you can think in reverse Polish. There is a learning curve required. The first couple of days that you use reverse Polish, it's going to seem so opposite from everything you've ever done. Whenever you've written down a formula, you always write down A multiply sign, B if you're doing a multiplication, or A, first number you'd write down, and then the plus sign, and then the second number, equals. You'll notice that a reverse Polish calculator does not have an equal key. And if it does have an equal key, it's there for writing formulas, not for calculating purposes. And that's because you want to write a formula in the algebraic format or syntax. And this machine allows me to write a program where portions of the program are being used in reverse Polish notation. Other portions of the program are being used in algebraic notation. Portions of the program are doing operations from Fortran. Other portions of the operation are doing operations from the basic language, and so on. And I can combine all of that into one line of code, and this machine figures out what the hell I want. So when I write programs and I store them in the memory of this machine, those programs become self-documenting. I can look at that program 2 years from now and know what it's doing. I don't have to go through a great big procedure to disassemble, so to speak, and rewrite it on a piece of paper to find out what it's doing. It's all in human language, from my point of view, on the 4 or 5 lines of that screen. So you can see why I'm in love with that machine. The day occasionally happens once per month in which I forget to put this darn calculator in my pocket before I leave the house and go to the plant. On a couple of occasions, I felt so naked for not having that thing in my pocket, because I use it almost every single day to answer people's questions or to do the work I'm doing at the salt mine, that on a couple of occasions I got 2/3 of the way to the plant, turned around, went back home to get the darn calculator. It's that much of a security blanket to me. I'm also using it as a digital assistant. I mean, as a portable digital assistant, whatever you call it. In other words, they've got everybody's phone number and all kinds of other information in there. So you were very noisy and a lot of dropout on the last transmission, Rich. Did I get close to what you were asking? I think you were sort of asking, what is reverse Polish and how do you do it? N2EO, if we can hear you. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Then tonight at 8 o'clock.
Okay, Jacob, forever from the mic. Is this any better?
Okay, you were dropping out before, not because of too much audio, because the RF was too weak. The propagation keeps changing. Right now you sound pretty good, so go ahead with your question or comment.
Okay, Jacob, I understand RPN. When I went to RCA Institute, believe it or not, there was one crazy instructor for...
Okay, Rich, we heard the first two sentences very clearly. After that, you had complete carrier dropout, except for an occasional burst for the next 60 seconds. So I think you're asking something about Hewlett-Packard 65 versus Hewlett-Packard 28. I think 65, if I remember correctly, was a pure, maybe I'm wrong. No, maybe I'm wrong. But one of those machines that Hewlett-Packard generated, because so many people were in the United States complaining about reverse polish, they made a pure algebraic machine. And maybe the 65 was it. But other than that, I don't know the full range of all the Hewlett-Packard calculators, I'm sorry to say. There are websites that will give you that. There are websites that will show you all the past history of handheld calculators with all their pictures and their characteristics and so on. Some beautiful data like that you can find on the World Wide Web. We've come a long way. I mean, all the crazy calculations I was doing in college with an IBM 16, I think it was called a 1620 machine, it filled up a room, this computer device.
Jake, I just want to tell you, there's a few guys that wrote programs for the that simulate those calculators so you can put them on your computer. They even have a picture of the calculator, and they are very plentiful on eBay. I happen to own two.
How about that? So I think you're saying that a person so enthusiastic about, say, a Hewlett-Packard 28 and doesn't own one, he could go to the right website that'll make his desktop computer act like a 28, and after that, you can do the calculations in that manner. Is that what you're saying, Barry?
Yes, I am. And there's several programs like that, yes. I haven't downloaded them for several years because I have the calculator. I've got two of them. But I did take them off the internet a few years ago, and they work great.
When I moved my antenna, Barry, what'd you pay for the Hewlett-Packard 28S, and are batteries available?
The batteries are available in Radio Shack, and it wasn't cheap. These guys that own them seem to know that they're worth something, so you're paying $150 to $200, sometimes as much as $300 for them. If the guy's got one in mint condition with a few accessories and all that nonsense, they're not cheap, but they are available.
Of the last two that I bought, I think I paid $125 each. Maybe I'm lucky. And because it's a discontinued product, maybe they're going to start getting more expensive. The only accessory you can buy for an HP28S is the external printer, which runs on an infrared bulb on the top of the machine. It speaks on infrared to its printer, and the printer is a small thermal printer. Not ideal, but it does work. Unfortunately, one of the things you're not going to like about the 28S is that there is no way to download to it. The only input it will accept is from its keyboard, whereas the later versions, the Hewlett-Packard 48 series, 48S, 48C, 48, eventually it was a 49, they would accept a kind of I.O. They had an input-output port, and you could download to them. That's the good news. Hewlett-Packard knew that the 28 calculator, which was reverse Polish plus five other languages, including algebraic, was not selling well in the United States, even though the Europeans couldn't get enough of them, even though they had to pay a premium price over there in Europe. The Europeans were buying them like they're going out of style. And they knew there was something wrong in the United States. They did a survey. Hewlett-Packard hired Madison Avenue to ask the engineers in the United States why they were not buying 28Ss. Well, because the people in the United States had never used a machine, no matter what they gave as an answer, it's a very biased answer. And probably the answer really was they weren't quite sure they would like a non-QWERTY keyboard, and they're not sure they would understand or be willing to make the investment to use reverse Polish notation. Maybe that was the real answer, and maybe it was also the price, but because Madison Avenue was being hired to give a good-sounding answer to Hewlett-Packard, the answer about the price being higher wasn't told to them. Madison Avenue told Hewlett-Packard that the American engineers do not like a folding calculator. They want a one-faced calculator. It was the wrong answer, but in the process of the very next machine came out with a non-folding, less than half the number of keys, a little bit larger screen, that's the good news, but now you need menus of menus in order to get to your individual favorite commands, the 2,600 commands in the machine. And how did you find your particular command compared to the other 2,599? You had to go, in some cases, three or four menus down, and the menus were not in a logical manner. You'd like to think that all the trigonometry is in one area and all the matrix information is in another area. It wasn't laid out that way. You'd like to think it was all laid out alphabetically. It wasn't laid out that way. Unless you memorized all of the menus, unless you had a cheat sheet in your pocket, you couldn't find your favorite command. So the user-friendliness of the machine was terrible, even though it had some really potent capability. That Hewlett-Packard 48 calculator would allow you to make a three-dimensional picture of an object on the screen and then roll that object. In 1995, that was a breakthrough to do all of that on a calculator. But to get the data into the machine, to get your commands into the machine, in my opinion, was a nightmare. I own each one of those modern machines, and there's a certain kind of calculation I can't do any other way except on that, and then I will climb into those machines. But day to day, I'm using the 28, the 1988-1989 invented machine. Maybe you've got some further comments on this, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW.
No, actually, I'll get back to you guys in a minute. I'm going on the internet to see if I can find the program, and if I do, I'll report back.
Now, sorry, I'm sorry here, Mel, that we got so far off of your original question that Tim was asking. I'm a little bit worried that your particular calculator may be laid out a little bit differently than Tim's, but I think Tim is getting the concept here. He now knows what the answer should look like, the intermediate answers, the 95.5 ohms, and you can have a grand old time when you go to the complete formula for resonance, 1 over 2 pi square root of LC. Again, because of that 1 over function with algebraic machines, it can be a little bit troublesome. Learning how to get that function out of your machine may take a few tries, and it may take writing yourself some notes to know how to do it on the machines that are a little bit less user-friendly. K2KEY, K2RIW in SECNAT.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, that's why I did it very slow. Now, Tim has and his friends have the Texas Instruments scientific calculator that's meant for people, I guess high school age, teenagers. And so I had to do a little research into that Texas Instruments calculator to figure out how to get the exponential minus for the PF, so when the end of 438.5 PF in that formula. So that's why I had to do, I could say, a little extra work in that direction to figure out how to do it with that calculator. The calculator I use is the Sharp EL5100 old. It was sold as the pocket slide rule. Nice compact thing. It's a nice little case. Thin enough to slip into your shirt pocket. It's about 56 inches long by about 3 inches wide by about a 3/8 thick. And because it gave me a very easy transition from slide rule, which many times I still like. I have my electronic slide rule from Tech. Every so often I, for some reason, slip back in because I can usually get a ballpark answer real quick with that, and then I don't use the calculator many times to check my answer. I got on a slide rule fix, and that shows age. So Sharp calculators, they got a whole slew of them and everything like that, but I guess they once you get used to a certain type of procedure, it's hard to get away. And I got also the function keys on the Sharp, basically the same idea. On the left, you got all the hyperbolic and sines and all, and arc and sine, cosine, tangent, all that stuff, and I have log ln, and natural log, and regular log, all on one side, and so it's so nice, and everything, and my storage keys, and all that stuff on the right side, the main keyboard in the middle, so, it's just what to get used to, Dick, over.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. If you did a thoroughly objective survey of which machines are user-friendly, I have an opinion as to what machines you would settle on. But at the time, Sharp, Casio, and TI were vastly more popular because they were roughly one-half to two-thirds of the price of the Hewlett-Packard at all instants of time. I mean, the Hewlett-Packard Model 35 pocket calculator, 1972 vintage, when it first came out, was something like $465 in 1972 dollars. That was big money. That machine did a lot compared to anything you saw up till that time. The price rapidly came down to something more reasonable in the $120 or so range, but Hewlett-Packard always came down in price more slowly than the other big three. When I say big three, I mean big three in sales, Sharp, Casio, and TI. Hewlett-Packard was always more expensive, and in my opinion, the foolish engineers were always looking for the biggest bang for the dollar. You go down the list of functions, every one of those machines had very similar functions. Then you looked at the dollars and you said, gee, TI, Sharp, or Casio gives me a lot more, a lot less dollars for the same function. And nobody asked themselves the question, how easy is it to get to those functions? And so I think they made the wrong decision. But that's my opinion. But back to you, Mel.
Be better signal now, Dick?
I think so. But each time you do this, you start off the first sentence or two we hear well, and then two sentences downrange, your carrier completely drops out and disappears. So let's hope you've got a better position. And by the way, when you position your antenna for best reception, it's not the best position for transmission, because the transmission's on a different frequency. Until it's being fed back to you by a second machine, positioning it for best transmission is kind of spooky. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, I did buy another FM rig. I'll be putting it up here in the bedroom in about a week. What I said was, when I went to RCA Institute, we had an instructor, fortunately, taught us RPN, so I am familiar with it. Roger?
Definitely got that time. And I think there was another question you were asking about the 65. I'm not quite sure what that meant. Go ahead.
Okay, it's just a number I remember. You have the 28S. It's the one with the programmable strips, magnetic strips.
Yes, I remember the magnetic strip machine. And I think you're right. There was a version called 65, and then they came out with a programmable one, which I think was called the 25, Hewlett-Packard 25, programmable, without the magnetic strips. And I think Barry owned one of the machines with the magnetic strips. Is that true, Rich?
Yeah, I believe so. And I believe that's a machine that somebody stole from him. That machine, is that similar to your 28S with the program, except with the programmable strips? And is that called the 65?
Yeah, the 65, I think, is the one with the programmable strip. And the reason for the programmable strips in those days is because they really didn't have non-volatile memory, and they didn't have very much memory. Modern-day machines have got tremendous memory capability and is non-volatile. In the case of the 28S, it runs on the sub-miniature, you know what an AA, a AA battery looks like. You know what a AAA battery looks like. If you take half the length of a AAA battery, it's called an N battery, N for Nancy. So the Hewlett-Packard 28S runs on three N cells. Those three N cells are good for more than 2 years before they need replacement. And the machine gives you a lot of warning before it needs replacement. However, if you are using a Hewlett-Packard 28S calculator, even though the batteries are good for 2 years, absolutely positively replace them within 1 year. Not because the batteries run down. What I discovered is that almost every brand of N cell has less than perfect sealing. Beyond about a year and a quarter, a tiny bit of the acid leaks out somewhere, and you start getting flaky contacts between the battery and the battery holder. And so if you always replace the batteries within 1 year, you don't run into that problem. On a couple of occasions, I've stretched it to 2 years, and on one or two occasions, the flaky contacts caused me to lose memory. When you unplug the batteries from the calculator, you've got something like 5 minutes in which its holding capacitor will hold its memory. Beyond 5 minutes, you might lose. So if you develop flaky contacts on the batteries that have been sitting in there for 2 years, and if that disconnect occurs for more than 5 minutes, you could lose all your valuable programming. Okay, let's go back to Mel, because I know he's got I know he's got some more juicy emails. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Question for Mel, WS2N.
Yes, go ahead, Paul.
Good evening, Mel. I want to find out if you guys are still on that net with your radio media loop on the, well, this is not the net, the schedule with KB3FRY. Is he on anymore? I tried a couple of three times last two weeks. I didn't hear anybody at that time, 11:30 right now.
Roger, Paul. Yes, what? George had to go to do all the, to give a friend a hand there. A friend of his went through that misery in New Orleans, and a good old buddy of his that, from, I believe, when he was in the military. So he went down to New Orleans to give the poor guy a hand, try to get his, he became, I think, the telephone from New Orleans, became in some way disabled. So he was pretty upset that he can't, you know, fix up some of his living situation down there. So he went down there for a few weeks. Then when he came back this past week, he found that the Zadie Heber antenna was now down, laying in the backyard, you know, shredded. Something happened to it. He said, he doesn't know what happened that it came down. So he's going to try this week, next day or two, to get it back up and to, you know, get back on the air. So almost like he'd be back with it in the next couple of days. So I know George, he'll be working on it tomorrow. He just got back to the Texas Press, and then he's going to get started on it. So we'll be back at it again, I'm sure, in the next couple of days. So keep listening. We'll be in the same place, and thank you for asking, Paul.
Okay, very good, Mel. Okay, well, if he's going to be a little bit with the antenna. I had a technical question for him, but maybe I'll ask on the net. So it dates back 50 years. Maybe somebody would know it here now.
You got a question from 50 years ago? I guess we're the right people. I'm the young guy, so I'm sure the older guy that's part of this tech net could answer it. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, you know, the equipment I'm talking about has nothing to do with radio. That's why everything pretty much has to do with the radio. But, Dick, this isn't radio-related. It's actually related to Lionel Train. This guy, George, that Mel's talking about, is an expert with the Lionel Train. I'm just trying to figure out how something works. Now, nothing's broken. I'm just curious about how this one thing works. Dick, can I pose that question?
Absolutely. It's electronics, and it's a subject of interest to ham radio operators. And I used to be an owner of an awful lot of Lionel trains, but unfortunately I have none anymore. You got it, Paul.
Okay. Here's the question that came up here. I've got this car here, you know, a Lionel car, and it creates a whistle. Now, the train itself is separate from the car, you know, the locomotive. Now, this is type O. Now, this runs AC, and the highest voltage I measured there was like 14.5 or something. It flew all the way up. And now your locomotive could really go like Siemens on this three-track system. Type O, you remember, has a center track was one line, and then the ground was the two outer sides. So, take a measurement, you get 14.5 volts pop out of this transformer, the 90-watt transformer. But now this one particular whistle car, what this has is I took apart, it looks like it's just a relay, and it's got a little motor in it, and this car that blows this whistle operates anywhere on the track, and it's got a relay in there, it's got a contact going to the center grid to operate the relay, to make the relay come on, and when the relay comes on, it brings the other contact on from the center track, and it starts up this motor, and this whistle starts. When you measure the voltage with it, now on this transformer, there's a special lever that you push over to the whistle direction. You take a reading on that. I'm reading up like 10.5 volts, less than the 14 max.
I'm just wondering how this relay knows how to come on. I don't see any diode network in there, so I don't think it's DC. I measured it with the AC meter. How does this whistle clock know to come on anywhere in the track, yet it's only putting out 10.5 volts? I mean, if I crank up the regular voltage, the AC to 14 volts, let's say, or anything above 10.5, that whistle doesn't come on, you know? I'm wondering, how does this 50-year-old technology or beyond, how did these guys figure this out? Back to your WS2F.
I've got a guess, but I'm not sure. When you, at the transformer, at the controls for your train, command the whistle to go on, I am guessing you're turning on a rectifier, which is putting out pulsating DC instead of AC. I think you told me the track is AC. And when you put out pulsating DC, that pulls in the relay. The relay itself, if they made it with enough Henrys of inductance on the coil of the relay, if the Henrys are high enough, the coil of the relay will ignore AC. It's got too much reactance to the AC, very little current forms, therefore it doesn't create much of a magnetic field, it doesn't pull in the armature of the relay. When you ask for whistle blowing, you're getting pulsating DC. The pulsating DC has an entirely different characteristic in the way it operates the armature of the relay, pulls in the relay, and now, even though it's a lower voltage, 10 and a fraction volts instead of 14, the motor keeps on running, and now the relay is pulled in, it runs the motor for the whistle, and you hear the whistle. That's my guess as to what I think is going on. The way you could confirm this is with the train on the track so that it's drawing current. You put your oscilloscope across the voltage leads, applying voltage to the track, and I think you're going to, and the scope has to be DC coupled. So with a DC coupled oscilloscope, you're going to see the 60 cycle AC waveform of 14.5 volts on the normal operation, and you're going to see that becoming pulsating DC when you command whistle. That's what I think is going on. Back to you, Paul.
Now, I think I know his answer too, Dick.
Go ahead. Maybe that was a guess on my part. And here's a train man from way back. Go ahead, Mel.
No, I just remember taking apart one of those transformers. The thing had two handles on it. Looked like, you know, like two, two throttle handles. And I remember something unusual. You know why? It had in there a rectifier. I think it was like a rectifier. It was a copper oxide rectifier, Dick. Now, I couldn't understand why they had that in there, but now it's putting two and two together. Do you remember, Dick, the copper oxide rectifiers over?
Sure do. Both copper oxide and selenium. In both cases, it's a bunch of fins that looks like a modern-day heat sink to some degree, but that's where the real rectification was taking place. Selenium rectifiers and copper oxide rectifiers look a little bit similar, I think. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, it was a little round one. That's why I have to remember it was mounted right on the side inside the case there. A round one. It was not a selenium. It was a copper oxide. I remember because, you know, the original rectifiers, before they used selenium, I think for low current bias supplies and all of this, you can see them in some of the old Collins rigs. They use copper oxide rectifiers, Dick, so I think they preceded the selenium, if I'm not mistaken, over.
You're probably right, but each of these rectifiers, be it selenium or copper oxide, by modern-day standards, they had a rather poor front-to-back ratio. Therefore, with the load of the train, the motor of the train on the track, you would see pulsating DC. Because the forward and reverse resistance of the rectifier was such a poor ratio, if there was no load from the train and you just put your oscilloscope directly on the supply voltage without that load, you'd see a pure AC signal. Whether you commanded whistle or not, you would think nothing is happening and you'd be very confused. So I wonder if you own a oscilloscope that has DC capability, Paul, and if so, when you put that on the track, I think you're going to say, aha. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. I was going to put that on it, but I wasn't sure about how I was going to read it. Now I am. Yeah, I got an old Heath kit, so I'll do that. And very, very good. So it is trying to put out a even back then DC, probably a Selenium rectifier or something in there. Very interesting. I put my regular AC meter on there, and I came out with a 10.5 volt. So if you don't have an oscilloscope, you just have a regular multimeter, or AC, DC, and you see two wires sticking out somewhere, and you take a measurement with these digital meters, there's really no way of knowing, unless I put it on the DC. I probably should have put that multimeter on the DC, and I might have seen a positive and negative result. Although, maybe not, because the AC would have still been on. So it's actually two completely different signals going across the track at the same time. No, it looks like you would definitely need to hook up an oscilloscope to check that. Wonder if there's any other quick and dirty way to check without an oscilloscope. But that's probably what's going on. I didn't think they were that advanced in the early 1950s to be trying to get DC out of something like that. Back to you.
Hey, Dick, I found the software on the internet for the 28S.
Very fine. We're going to be back to you in a minute there, Barry. You could, if you're smart enough, use an old-fashioned volt-ohm milliammeter. The old-fashioned triplet and Simpson volt-ohm milliammeters have an AC scale, a DC scale, and an output function. In the case of the so-called output function, when you flip the red wire over to another plug on the front panel, you were capacitively coupled into the meter. And that was intended for you to measure the audio output on a audio output transformer primary. Back in the old days when you had a tube as the final audio amplifier going into an audio output transformer that went into the loudspeaker, and you want to calculate, and you want to find out what's going on at the plate of the tube, because the DC voltage on the plate of the tube would dominate the meter. Say, for instance, they got 150 volts on the plate. All you could do is go to the 150 volt full scale or higher, 300 volt scale, and yeah, you'd measure the fact that DC is there. That doesn't tell you whether or not there's any audio coming out. When you went over to the output mode, which was a capacitively coupled pin on the front panel, you would then go through that capacitor, the 150 volts on the plate would disappear, and only the AC component would now go through the meter. You put the meter into the AC mode, and you'd measure the amount of RMS, or average AC voltage. So by way of using an old-fashioned volt-ohm milliammeter, when you're using the capacitive coupling, you would see the fact that the DC meter showed zero, but the AC meter would show you some signal when you're in the whistle-blow mode, which is pulsating DC, and you would see something like 10 volts and 14 volts, whistle-on mode, whistle-off mode. When you're directly coupled into the meter, into the normal run mode, where there's 14 volts of AC, the DC mode of the meter, if you look with a magnifying glass, you would see that the needle is trying to wiggle back and forth 60 times per second, but it can't do that. It doesn't go anywhere. But in the AC mode, you'd see the 14.5 volts. You've already saw what happens when you go into the whistle blow mode. The 14.5 seems to go down to 10 point something volts. However, the RMS of that is still running the train at roughly the same speed. You're about to ask, how come the train at 14 volts in the whistle-off mode and 10.5 volts in the whistle-on mode, the train runs at the same speed? And there's a bunch of complicated answers there as to what is the reactance of the motor of the train with those various combined signals. So a person who's smart enough, who uses all the modes of a volt-ohm milliammeter, would be able to figure it out. But it's an indirect set of measurements and an interpretation of those measurements. So once you know the secret that there's some pulsating DC there, I think you're going to be able to check it both ways, with your voltohm meter and with your oscilloscope. Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
DAV.
Very good. Okay. I'm going to do both. I will bring the oscilloscope down there and poke around with it. Very good. I think, I'm telling you, the